Welcome to the Natural Selection Podcast.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Natural Selection Podcast. Today myself, Sasha and Amelia are excited to be joined by Peter Verleben, a German forester and best-selling author who's dedicated much of his life to deepening his understanding of trees and sharing their story. His newest book, The Heartbeat of Trees, explores the latest research and scientific discoveries, uncovering how humans and the natural world interact with one another. We hope you enjoy.
Well, hello and welcome, Peter. Thank you so much for joining us today to talk about your new book, The Heartbeat of Trees. So by trade, you're a forester and a best-selling author. So we wanted to start off by asking you, what were some of your earliest experiences with nature that you can recall? And can you pinpoint a time or an experience which really influenced your passion for forestry and your connection with nature?
My connection with nature, I think, began from the very, very first, yeah, let's say perhaps not for the first year, but for the third year or so on. I always loved animals. I kept spiders in glasses. I had a big aquarium on my desk when I was a child with water turtles, and there I came into very direct contact with nature, because you have to change the water every 3 to 4 days because it's full of poop. And without a pump, you have to, I don't know if you know how it works, to bring water out of the aquarium, out of the window with a tube. You have to suck a little bit and then bring it right in the right moment out of the window. And when you're not fast enough, you're going to taste nature. So I love things like this. In school, I was always interested in biology. And after school, I thought about studying biology. And then I read in a newspaper that the German Forest Commission was searching for students. And I thought, okay, a forester is someone like a tree keeper, perhaps someone like an ant in Lord of the Rings. That's a perfect job. But afterwards, when I started practicing forestry, it turns out that a forester is more like a tree butcher. And then I traveled around and looked how other forests are managed and how they could be environmentally friendly managed. And then the journey started.
Amazing. And what influenced you to kind of start communicating and storytelling about your experiences, nature and particularly trees?
The storytelling, some people think, he writes a book and thought about how the best language would be. No, I make guided tours since around about 30 years. And when you talk to the people and you use too much technical terms, then you get punished, because people think, that's boring. And then they start talking together and not listening anymore. And that's not really nice when you're a guide. So I try to avoid the technical terms, talk to in a more emotional language, and which is, of course, better for the trees, because there are so many amazing things going on between trees. For example, how can you say that mother trees are caring for their offspring without using the term mother tree? It's a very old term. It's used for centuries in Germany, even among foresters. And the famous storytellers, the brothers Grimm, they have made a dictionary in 1860, and they already used the term mother tree. So there's always a little emotional inference among foresters, but not in this sense that they tell how good trees cooperate and that they even may feel pain, because that would disturb business, of course.
Did you always write about?
No. I never wanted to write. After, let's say, 20 years of guided tours, more and more people ask, where can we read more about? Is there any book? I had to say no, I don't know. Any book. And then they asked my wife, who worked for the a little village here at that time, and she said, Peter, please write down at last 10 pages or so, so that I can hand out a little story to the people. And I always refused. And but one day, because love is a strong thing, I said, okay, I'll write a little book and send it to some publishers. And if no one wants to publish it, then that's it. And that was how it started.
Wow, amazing.
Yeah. Well, yeah, your books are very beautifully written and very poetic. And it obviously brings a lot of character to trees. I was just wondering, because your book does carry a slightly less like scientific tone, do you think it's less acknowledged by the scientific community? Or are you trying to do a different role here in inspiring and engaging people?
I think I'm perhaps a translator, scientific language, lay people language. There are some forest scientists, of course, who are saying, oh no, that are just fairy tales, because it isn't a scientific language, although the facts are hard proven. But I think I can stand that critics, because I know what is the deeper sense of it. As I said, it disturbs business and they fear to lose their jobs when more people think it's not a good idea to clear cut big forests. But in general, more and more universities have special persons to translate the latest discoveries. When you browse on their web pages, then you find more and more press releases which are written in nearly the same tone than that I write my books, because otherwise no one would participate from their discoveries, and that's also a question of money for the universities to get support. So there's the change going on, but there are some old hardliners who say no. That's too emotionally, and that's not scientifically written. And I say, yes, I'm guilty in this. I'm not aiming at the brain, I'm aiming at the heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the best way to engage the wide community that you've reached, I think. So throughout your book, you kind of set little challenges for the readers to encourage them to get out in the forest. And Sasha and I have been trying to implement these in our walks around Cornwall this week. But we just wondered, why have you tried to encourage your readers to do this? What's the purpose of this to you?
I think perhaps we think about whales, the protection of whales in the ocean. Most of us don't like whale hunting. Mm-hmm. And it's not because we are all biologists and we know everything about whales, but it's because we love whales, even though most people haven't seen any. And because they are wonderful creatures, and we know they have a own language, and they travel in family bands, and they can become very old, and they're very big, and they are, let's say, the trees of the ocean. and with trees, it's nearly the same, but they are far evolutionary seen far away from us. They don't have eyes, they don't have lungs, and so on. But in many ways, they are similar. And I try to bring people closer to this, and to show them that we are still connected and with all of our senses, not just with our eyes and ears, but also with our smells, even the gut whatsoever reacts on tree communication, for example. So that my aim is that we get an emotional bond to trees, to nature, and that we realize that we are still part of nature. I think most of us have realized this during the pandemic, that we can't control nature completely, that we are still part of nature in a very bad way. And I try to bring it in a good way so that we protect nature instinctively, and not just because we think it's a good idea.
Mm-hmm. And without giving too much away from your book, what are some of the benefits of getting out in nature?
For example, our blood pressure sinks because we are participant in tree communication. Our human system gets better. We get more, let's say, killer cells, which defeat cancer cells. So there is, it's not a communication, but we benefit from trees in this way and in other ways too. I think that's not a problem of Brittany to have more rain or cooler temperatures, but in Germany, the more you get into the continent, the harder it gets. For example, the last three summers were very hot, very dry, but in forest it wasn't the case. Forest were around about 10 degrees cooler, They over forests, we had much more rain clouds. So forests create their own climate. And they're not so much depending on the things of climate change than we do. So if we would have more resilient forests, we would benefit also with our cities. And so there's a lot of exchange going on. But what we see in the moment, that worldwide we are weakening forests by clear cuts, by heavy thinning, by replacing forests with plantations. And we should review that.
Yeah, sure. So in your first book, The Hidden Life of Trees, and in this book, obviously you bring kind of a lot of emotive connection to trees and explore the ideas around consciousness, their ability to see, feel pain, sleep, and even have a heartbeat. You also describe forestry, as you said, as being a tree butcher and compare clearing plantations to almost factory farming. So how do you integrate that philosophy into your forest management practices?
It's, if you know all this, it's very hard to harvest timber anymore. And that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm now more on the protection side, because there are enough old school foresters who are still making clear cuts and, let's say, factory farming of trees. So we have, our forest range here is meanwhile a protected area with old beech tree forests. And we try to persuade more and more forest owners to go on the same path, so that we get a little bit more wilderness in Europe. In Germany, so far, we have 0.6% wilderness. That means areas which are allowed to develop on themselves. 0.6%, that's almost nothing. We are always looking to Brazil or Indonesia and say, wow, they had to have to protect their rainforest. But just to say, Brazil has, I think, run about 70% of the rainforest left. It's a pity that they are destroying them. But here in Europe, we have the biggest problems, because in Great Britain, in Germany, I think also in France, there is not a single square meter of primeval forest left. And we should let come them back. And so we started in front of our door, and that is the forest district here in the Eifel region.
I also found it interesting, you were talking about the local rituals where young men go out into the forest and cut down trees for their girlfriends as a sort of token of their love. And you kind of engaged in this yourself. I just kind of wondered how you look back on that.
Yeah, that's interesting how culturally connected we are. Concerning this, I don't know if there's anything similar in Britain.
I'm not sure, to be honest.
Because you're also very traditional, cultural thing going back to the Celtic times. So I think there should be similar things, but it's very regional. It's all about birch trees here, and you've. What is very important, you have to cut those trees illegal. So I don't allow them to do so, but I don't punish them for that. That's a big difference, because there's always a little sense of danger when you go out in the forest at nighttime, of course, because no one should see you. And then you have to carry this tree, which is really heavy, because the bigger it is, the better it is to show your love to your girlfriend. And that means that you, in general, you try to bring out a tree which is, let's say, at minimum 10 meters, more is better in length. And you have to bring this tree up against a house wall, which the parents don't like, of course, because sometimes you damage something. And you have to bring colorful paper bands into the crown. And that's how it works. And of course, I'm married now since more than 30 years, so I'm not practicing this anymore, because it's just as long as you're not married. When you're married, you don't have to demonstrate that you're fighting for your girl. What I'm doing, I'm not looking into the forest. It's always in the night into the 1st of May when this is done. And at this time, I stay at home.
And I mean, you talk a lot about connecting people and nature, and you seem to kind of agree that the Romantics gave forests a positive image, at least in Europe. And this idea of nature as a spectacular site of beauty to be preserved is often what triggered the creation of national parks and protected areas, which are essentially protecting natural spaces from humans. So do you think protected areas are necessary to protect forests, or does it just widen the gap between people and nature, which you are trying to bridge, really?
Yeah, it depends on how you protect the forest. I think we need a lot of more protected areas. I think, again, at Brazil, I think every one of us, like the remaining 70%, should be protected. But what does mean protection? In general, in European protected areas, no one is allowed to take a step outside the path. And I think that's not a good idea, because you're completely right that that makes the distance bigger. I think the only thing which should be forbidden in protected areas are chainsaws. When you don't fell trees, and when the protected area is big enough, that's the other thing. When you have just small spots and they get overcrowded, okay, then people can damage this little forest. But when you have, for example, forest the size of Yellowstone, then I think it is okay when people walk across the forest, because for animals, as long as there is no hunting, and that's the next big thing, no chainsaws, no hunting. And when animals don't fear people, then they get relaxed. And it doesn't matter if you have thousands of people passing through a forest, because a deer or white boar or foxes or whatsoever, they don't have to run away because there's no danger. So I think these two things are very important. And in German national parks, I don't know how it is in Britain, German national parks, there are clear cuts being made. There is hunting. And I would say, no, it's a national park that should be an oasis for nature without any active influence. That's the main point.
And so what I found particularly interesting in your book is when you talked about your conversations with the philosopher Kocher about the dominating ideas, certainly in Western science, about the need to organize species into this hierarchy and placing humans at the top of that. So what do you think the effect of this has been on Western culture and the connection that people then have with nature?
Yeah, the thing is we get a worse understanding of nature, because we think everything which is good, mankind invented, or it was invented for the human species. Let's say emotions, intelligence, pain, whatsoever. And we say, wow, even pigs can feel pain. And now when I say as a forester, even trees can feel pain. Oh no, that's esoteric. Because we divide it in these different categories. And in reality, it turns out that plants invented all this hundreds of millions of years ago before it was invented for our species. So it's no wonder that for example, that trees live in family bands and that they care for each other and that they have a communication system and so on, because it's more necessary for trees than for us. Our strategy, when we see a danger approaching, we can run away. And a tree has to stand where it is. So it's for a tree, it's much more necessary to realize a danger in advance. And therefore, because it's not able to walk around, it needs the help of other trees, which are nearer to the danger, for example. But this ranking makes it much more harder to understand nature. And this ranking means that we are a little bit outside the whole system, and that we are the controller of the system, and which we aren't, again, as we see now during the pandemic. So it's much better to see that we are within a system. Or as Emanuele Kocher said, if we would like to have a ranking, plants rank higher because they produce all the food. And without plants, we wouldn't be here. We benefit from plants. We are not able to produce anything really necessary without the help of plants.
Yeah, that's so interesting. But this view of humans as superior to nature, it's so entrenched in our education system here in the West and in the textbooks. Do you think there is scope to shift this view into changing the view into all living things as equal, and maybe even placing plants as equal or above animals?
I think we don't have to say they are equal, because, for example, when you are walking through the Serengeti National Park in Tanzania, and you will meet a lion, the lion wouldn't say, no, wouldn't say I'm equal or you are equal. You would say I'm hungry and would eat you. So I think it's okay to be egoistic as a human species, but we have to get aware of this egoism, and it's not a better ranking. So it's necessary to see that other creatures have also abilities, and we are something special. We, for example, I think trees are not able to make a podcast or write books. That's something special to humans. But when it comes to emotions, feelings, and interaction, then most species are as good as we are. And when we think about what is really important for our life, it's not our intelligence, that are our emotions, love, happiness, whatsoever. And there we are not something special.
Yeah. Wow. Obviously, trees are great at removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, so they play a role in combating climate change. But as you already mentioned, they have this amazing ability to cool local climates, and I think you mentioned that old growth forests are particularly good at that. So when we talk about carbon offsetting schemes, which plant new trees as a way to mitigate against mass deforestation of these older forests, do you think that's an effective tool in tackling climate change, or should we be putting more effort into saving old growth forests?
Yeah, I think we need both. When we now see, say, we plant forests and they store carbon for the CO2 we emitted by flying or driving cars, then it's a technical thing, a technical view on nature. We say, okay, use trees to pay our duty. And in reality, we should restore ecosystems, not just for carbon storage. Trees are not responsible for what we are doing to the atmosphere, so it's not their duty to bring it off. We should save energy. We should do less consumption of nature goods, and we should restore big ecosystems. Because what we are doing now is we destroy more and more ecosystems because we think it's good for the climate. One example: you have a big power company, for the gain of electricity, those power plants are changing their energy from coal to wooden pellets. Therefore, there's a big destruction of forests in the southeastern USA. And it's regarded to be carbon neutral. In reality, it turned out most scientists now say, no, it's 1.4 times worse for the climate than the burning of coal. And in this sense, we are destroying a lot of nature to get a different form of electricity, so thought more environmentally friendly, and by the way, destroying more nature. I think we need another look, another view on nature, that we have to say, no, we can't calculate, we emit carbon dioxide and as we have to store it everywhere. No, we have to let nature come back in bigger areas, whether they store carbon or not, because it's not sure that forests store carbon any longer. For example, the Amazon rainforest is now emitting carbon dioxide and not store anymore. Therefore, it should be useless. No, but it's a hotspot of biodiversity. And to be honest, in Europe, we have not very many hotspots of biodiversity at minimum on land. So we have to think different, not to compensate, but to give something back.
Yeah. I think were you just talking about Drax? Because it was quite interesting. Yeah, I was reading your book, and then this week in the New Scientist, it came up about that company, because they're trying to be the world's first carbon negative power plant by importing wood pellets. It was like kind of they grow these forests, burn them, get the energy, and then take it underground. So I'm guessing you don't think that's a particularly effective.
No, no. For example, I'm an absolute fan of solar cells, because you can put them on every roof. You don't need additional space. We have it on our house here. We can use it for our electric car, which isn't good for the environment, but it is not that bad for the environment. That's also something different. We can't do anything good to the nature. We can keep our hand in our pockets. We can use less raw material. We can consume less. But there's nothing. Even green cotton is not good for nature. Yeah. It is not that bad than common cotton material. So dregs can't become carbon neutral. That's nonsense. If for me, it's greenwashing to say burning ecosystems is good for nature.
I think, yeah, you see this greenwashing behavior a lot in companies as well. The attention in the media is massively influencing people to shift away from plastic products. And in replacement of that, the pressure is being placed on wooden products and paper and paper bags and things like this. And companies are even using it to label themselves as more environmentally friendly. What do you think is the most sustainable way to then make these decisions? Because, yeah, you have this narrative from the media saying move to wood, but actually, as we've discussed, maybe that's not the best solution.
I think there are many solutions. The main thing which everyone can do in right now in the moment is to eat less meat. Meat is the main driver of climate change. It's not coal, it's not oil. They are also driver of climate change, but the main driver is meat. And the calculations about the carbon footprint of meat, they are in most cases wrong. Because, for example, when you have a meadow with cattle, you have to calculate what a forest would do instead of this meadow. And most people just calculate how much oil the machines need and the transportation and the factory of meat products. And then you get a carbon footprint of meat. No, the carbon footprint of meat is the lack of a forest instead in this area. And when you compare this, around about half of our carbon footprint comes from meat consumption. And for example, in Germany, we have 114,000 square kilometers of woodland, and we have 100,000 square kilometers for meat production, for animal food. And I'm a vegetarian, but if more people would just eat meat on, let's say, Sundays, like it was a former time, we could restore, I think, 50% more woodland than now. And I think it's the same in Britain or United States or wherever you come. So it's about meat, and you can decide it every day on your plate.
Yeah, love that.
So you're vegetarians or vegan? Yeah, we are 90% vegan, but not 100% because I love the eggs from our chicken. But my daughter is 100% vegan, and she's convincing us. And I think just take some month and then it's done.
Yes. Going back to products and buying material products, you mentioned in your book about the Forest Stewardship Council, who are used as a marker for sustainable practices, but actually they can even approve bad practices like clear cutting. So is there a certification scheme that people can trust, or is there anything else that people can kind of use as an indicator to make well-informed decisions when investing in wood products?
No, so far I don't any good seal, because I've seen from FSC, for example, I've seen timber from clear-cutted primeval forests in Sweden, for example. It was a very sad look. I've seen certified timber from national parks in Germany. Say, a national park and certified timber, how does it work? No, I think the best thing is not to buy timber from primeval forests, but all other timber is in general not a good idea. Although I love wooden products. For example, I'm sitting here at a wooden desk. It's from a elm which died from insect attacks. But I think the main thing is to use less timber. Less paper, less timber, more recycled products, or, for example, furniture, which you can pass to the next generation. I think it's all about less consumption. And but there isn't any seal where you can say, oh, I don't have to think anymore what I'm buying. I just have to look after this seal and everything is good. No, we haven't such a seal. Like with fish, the MSC, you have the same problem. Oh, but you don't eat fish and me too. So we don't have that problem.
Is there a market? So you mentioned that your desk was made out of an elm that was diseased. Is there a market for maybe products which come from trees which are kind of on their way out?
To be honest, this elm would have been better stayed in the forest, even if it was dead, because dead wood you need for the water storage, for humidity, for thousands of insects. So it's for the tree, it was okay, because I think this tree hadn't feel pain while cutting, or it could be cut down, but that's the only thing. This desk was made by a local craftsman. It's all also about transportation. It's a bad thing for nature to use this timber, but it's better than replacing it every 5 or 10 years. What is also very important, if you decide to buy a wooden thing, and if you use it with pleasure, because it's always worth to think before buying, but afterwards it's just to become into a bad mood. That's not worth the time. So we should enjoy our wooden product, or my ukulele here in the background. I hope, hopefully, it will last also very long.
Yeah, just being mindful
again. You seem very hopeful in your book about the future of people's relationship with nature and believe positive change is happening. But at the same time, it does feel like politicians aren't taking the climate crisis seriously enough, and people are still encouraged to excessively consume. So do you feel like enough is being done? And finally, is there anything in particular that has given you hope for the future?
There are many signs of hope. First, perhaps when you see the High Court of Germany, for example, they made, I don't know the English term in German, it's Urteil, when they judged someone, in this case, the German government, that they have not done enough for the next generation concerning climate change. So in Germany, they speed up concerning laws, concerning things about renewable energy in the moment, because the High Court judged the German government, I think 2 or 3 months ago. In the Netherlands, we saw a similar thing with Shell. They were judged to save, I think, 45% of carbon emissions within the next years. And so there are many, many things on this way. Or look in the United States, the climate conference from Joe Biden. He made it within, I think, 2 weeks, convinced China, Russia, and Brazil, although it was not enough, to do something more against climate change. And when we look at the ecosystems, you have to look beneath the railways or old industrial areas where you have the worst situation for forests to come back, because it's very hot there, it's very dry there, and all over there where people let their hands out, you see new trees growing. So the trees can stand all this as long as they are allowed to come back. And so I think there's a lot of hope, but we have to hurry a little bit up.
Thank you so much. It's great to speak to you, giving us a lot of important things to think about.
Yeah, hopefully inspire people to get out into nature and reconnect with what's around them.
And that's it for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and make sure to check out Peter's newest book, The Heartbeat of Trees, as well as his other books, including The Hidden Life of Trees, for a whole new perspective on what forests are capable of. And to keep up to date with all our latest podcast episodes, you can give us a follow on Instagram at thenaturalselection_podcast and on Twitter at UOE Podcasts. Until next time.